It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of August the 6th, 2006. He has been in service as secretary and sponsored many people. And his AA motto is Reliance on God. So, without any further ado, may I have the envelope, please? Woo-hoo. The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week award is Nick C. from Orange Cove. Sally?
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Academy. My name is Nick Appoletti. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My God-given sobriety date is August 6th of 2006. A little bit about my home group. I'm from Primary Purpose, just down the street, Bridge Street. We meet Thursday nights, and we're big book thumpers. You know, we really take the big book serious, and we take people through the book. We take them through to experience it rather than for the educational variety. And our format is where we turn statements into questions. And we find either people really hate it or people really like it. We really don't have anything in between. But we are able to latch on to a few of you guys and girls and go through the process with us. A little bit about myself. I'm originally from Toledo, Ohio. It's an industrial town. It's a lot like, in its heyday, it was just like Detroit. It spit out just as many cars. You know, we have a big glass industry, you know, Jeep, Ford, and there's a lot of generational factory workers, you know, that had fathers that were factory workers, grandfathers that had factory workers, and very cold, and really all there was left to do in the winter was to drink. You know, and for me, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I had a dad that drank, and I was raised in an Italian-Irish family, and my dad was sort of like the Fonz. You know, he really was. I mean, he was cool. He owned bars. You know, he always had a lot of cash. People gave him respect, and I loved being with my dad. My dad's one of us. And when I would go to bars with him, you know, he was like my trophy dad, you know. I mean, you know, people paid respect to my dad, you know. And I remember the very first time I actually remember experiencing alcohol was my dad had a few too drinks one night, and he thought he'd get a kick out of putting me on a bar stool and feeding me some peppermint schnapps. And I was like about 6 years old. And I really don't remember the effect I got from it, but one thing I do remember is just how much everybody just laughed, right? Everyone was looking at me. You know, I was Billy Badass up on that stool, you know, at 6 years old. And, you know, even when I wrote inventory, I really had never had resentment towards my dad about that. A lot of other things, actually, a lot of resentments came up when he was in AA. But, well, what ended up happening is my dad finally got sober, and, you know, like a lot of people do in AA, they have good intentions, but now the whole family is going to get recovery now, right? So, I mean, I was launched into therapy, family therapy with my dad, my mom, and my little brother. I was shipped off to Alateen meetings twice a week, and I think it's safe to say I graduated from Alateen and into AA. But, you know, the thing that was funny with my dad was I never got to see him when he was drinking. And the same thing sort of happened when he got sober. You know, I still wasn't able to see my dad a lot. You know, meetings were really important to my dad. You know, service commitments, general service was very important to my dad. It's just I didn't really get to see a lot of them, you know. And I'd say about my junior high year, that's when I started actually drinking. And I remember the very first time I ever drank, the experience that I had is that when I drank some hard liquor, and it was on Thanksgiving vacation, and we were over at my buddy's house, and we raided his liquor cabinet, his dad's. And I remember when I took a whiff of that alcohol, and I thought it was the nastiest stuff I've ever smelled in my life. Really, after I smelled it, I had no intention of drinking it. But I saw everyone else was drinking a little bit. So as I began to drink it, it did something to me that it wouldn't do to a normal junior high student. And what it did to me is, in a weird sense, it completed me. There was something inside me already lacking. There was already something inside me that alcohol was filling up. It worked for me, you know. And what happened, I have to admit, the time that I remember, what we call the phenomenon of craving kicked in. Because I didn't set out to drink. When I did drink, I was going to have a couple swigs. I ended up just losing all control. And, of course, I was the most drunk one there, so I was messed with the most. My mom told me when I came home that day I had toothpaste in my hair. They just completely hazed me, you know what I mean? But, you know, I really liked how it made me feel. And I remember it was Thanksgiving Eve, so I woke up the morning of Christmas, Thanksgiving, and I was just about ready to puke, you know, still drunk, and my mom cooked the best Thanksgiving meal, and I'm partial, and I'm sure you're all partial, I'm sure you all have the best Thanksgiving meals, but you know, it was something every year I looked forward to eating, but I could not eat it. I mean, the turkey tasted like whiskey, the mashed potatoes tasted like whiskey. I drank milk and it tasted like it had whiskey in it. And I remember saying to myself in that day, I said, I am never drinking again. This is nuts. And you know, I know a lot of people that got drunk when they're at that age and they got so drunk, they never drank again. Why am I drinking a year from that time, the my next Thanksgiving vacation? But what happened is I never made that resolution again. You know, I started to actually continuously drink my eighth grade year into my high school years. And, you know, it started out with just on the weekends. And, you know, what I was talking about, the phenomenon of craving, that happened early on for me. And what I mean by that is, you know, I would go to those parties, you know, and I would, you know, have my jock friends. I would have my regular friends. I had my artsy friends, you know. And I'd go out to a party with them, and I try to keep up with them, you know. You know, John's having a couple beers. I'm going to nurse my beers like John. Or, you know, Frank is drinking like this. I'm going to drink like Frank. It never happened, ever. I would drink so much, I'd go into a blackout, wouldn't remember what happened. I'd show up at school the next day on a Monday and be like, dude, what is wrong with you? And I would ask, well, what happened? He goes, dude, you started a fight with the biggest guy in the party. You tried headbutting and he moved and you fell over and hit your face on the carpet. And I remember thinking to myself, man, I'm like, man, you know, there was these consequences already happening early on in my drinking. You know, I saw that I was losing control. And I was getting to a point where, you know, it was becoming a problem. Now, how I ended up in my first treatment center, well, it's sort of a funny story. You know, we have our public schools, we have our parochial schools, and a lot of our parochial schools are either, you know, St. John's is all boy, St. Ursula, all those are all girl, And I remember we were out partying with these rich girls one night, and we're in a van, and my brother's one of us, he's still out there struggling, and my brother and his friend decided that they were going to steal a motorcycle and drive to Chicago and take it to Chicago. The only problem was is this motorcycle didn't work, and it was like 10 below zero, right? So we pull up next to this garage that they're going to steal this motorcycle from, and my buddy takes like 20 to 30 minutes trying to get this motorcycle out. And the whole time, neighbors are watching it, and Crime Stoppers was called, so the police were watching us watching them the whole time. And sure enough, you know, my buddy was able to cart that motorcycle across the street, and we're all thinking, wow, these guys are going to take off to Chicago, you know, and it didn't happen, you know, it didn't work, and we end up getting back in the van, And only two streets down, we had two paddy wagons behind us, and we got out and they arrested us. And I was really humiliated that night. And what was really humiliating was these girls coming from a really good background. I mean, seeing their parents come in, man, it just, they were disgusted with us. I mean, we were hoodlums, you know what I mean? And I thought to myself, man, this is just making me feel like crap. And I was facing juvenile hall, some jail time in CSI is what we call it. And my other alternative was going into a rehab. And I went in my first rehab at my freshman year, and actually, through the grace of God, I actually was able to stay sober for a year. So I was introduced to AA for the first time. And one thing that I noticed when I was going to AA is I was back by my dad's side. You know, I was going to meetings with my dad. And back east in Toledo, there's tons of speaker meetings just like this. You know, in basements of churches. Just as many people as we've got in here today. Actually, I haven't been back in a while, but open discussion meetings aren't really big. It's the speaker meetings. And, what we did back there is, you know, if a guy came in and everyone's sitting here, you were to shake the hand of every single person in that room. And what blew me away was I was really, really taken by the spirit of the fellowship. You know, I thought it was cool, shaking hands. You know, some of my most profound spiritual experiences that I had is hearing, 200 people sing the Lord's Prayer. You know, there's something in that really sunk in. The only problem was that spiritual experience didn't last too long. So I would go to these meetings, and the first thing that I noticed is back then there weren't a lot of young people. You know, there's actually people that I remember that were sober back then that knew Bill. You know, a lot of people that fought in World War II. And that was the first thing that I remember. I'm sitting in a meeting, and I'm having to relate to somebody that was in World War II, and a guy that drank for 20 or 30, 40 years. And it was hard for a kid like me that didn't drink as long, right, to identify with that person. And so what I learned early on was an alcoholic is a person that drinks a lot of alcohol, right? And I began to get these preconceived ideas about AA from a very early age. You know, there were ideas impressed upon me in AA that I later found out weren't really true, at least for me, my own experience. Just to let you guys know, tonight you're going to hear some stuff from me that maybe you've never heard before. I might say some things that challenge your ideas, your belief systems. You might get uncomfortable a little bit. You know, I know I did when I heard the message that I'm about to give to you guys. But this is the message that I needed. Now, there's some people out there that are doing whatever you're doing, and it's working. There's absolutely no reason to fix something that's not broken, right? But for those repeat offenders, right, for those people that can't seem to get a substantial amount of sobriety without going back out, those are the ones I'm talking to tonight, you know? And whatever I've got to say, just let it bake. That's what my sponsor would say, man. Just let it bake, you know? Think about it. Pray for an open mind tonight to hear what I've got to say. So when I came into AA, as I was saying, I got lost in AA, I would go into meetings and I would hear, everyone's got their own solution. But that was confusing to me, right? Because when I was coming in, how was I going to find my own solution? There was really no one there to really show me a solution other than going to meetings. So, basically after that year, I went back out. And I never got a substantial amount of sobriety until 1999. But a little bit about what was going on in between there. I had burnt my bridges in Toledo. In high school, I got to a point where no one wanted to be around me. Absolutely no one. My friends that I drank with, that drank sometimes harder than me, were like, Nick, you got a problem with alcohol. I'm not drinking with you. You know, you end up going out with me, you end up hitting on my girlfriend, right? And, I'm sorry, she's good looking, but And I got nobody. You know, what am I supposed to do? So I ended up packing my bags and moving to Chicago. When I lived in Chicago for about 6 months, I did no drinking. You know, I guess I was one of those dry alcoholics. You know, I wasn't drinking. I was living with my brother and a sister-in-law. I was working in the city, and things were going okay. Well, prior to that, I had broke up with my girlfriend, and she had moved to Truckee. Well, things were starting to look pretty sour in Chicago. Because, right, I'm just moving everything with me. You know, that ball and chain, I'm just moving with me to Chicago. Well, when I was starting to overstay my welcome there, getting back with my girlfriend in California was starting to sound like a good idea to me. And truthfully, you know, I was missing her, you know. And so I ended up moving to Truckee, and I sort of did a weird bouncy. I went from Truckee back to Toledo, back to Truckee, and I ended up in the Central Valley. I did an enormous amount of drinking with this girl that I was with. I put her through the ringer. I put her through so much of a ringer, I've made an approach to making amends, and she told me that she's not ready yet. You know, I really took a hostage with this one. And I really hurt the woman that's here in the front here, the wife that I'm with now. And, but in this time, I was still hitting meetings. You know, I still had brief periods of sobriety. And like I said, I could never hold on to a lot of time. Up until 1999, I did come into these rooms, and I was actually, through the grace of God, was able to stay sober almost 3 years. And I did it with meetings, I did it with a sponsor, I did it with general service. You know, I was your Mr. AA. You know, I don't know what your experience is like, but I was always Mr. Something. You know what I mean? When I was in a rehab, I was the counselor, right? I ran the show to find out that the one that runs the show is usually the sickest of the bunch. You know, I was either the best sponsee. You know, I was the best of what, I was a great starter, you know? But you know, like I said, I was in and out of AA. I was getting a lot of sobriety. And I finally came into the rooms in 1999, and I was able to stay sober for almost 3 years. But what began to happen in that last year was I began to feel empty. It wasn't working for me anymore just to go to meetings. It wasn't working anymore for me to participate in general service. It wasn't working for me going out with my friends and having coffee all the time. It wasn't working for me to be surrounded by AA fellowship all the time. It wasn't working. And I was becoming depressed. And later find out what that was the bedeviled life, what we call untreated alcoholism. What began to happen is that alcoholism was beginning to creep back into my life without alcohol. Okay? So basically, I'm basically just crazy in AA. Well, I'm thinking, you know, and I would tell my sponsor, I'd be like, you know, I'm depressed. He's like, well, Nick, you need to pray. I didn't know what to pray for. You know, I was so blocked by the sunlight of the Spirit and so confused about my condition, there was no way I could even attempt to truthfully pray to a God. And I would find I was getting more miserable and more miserable, and what ended up happening is I convinced myself that I was just crazy. I'm nuts. I need antidepressants. I need all this stuff, and I'll get off the drinking. Well, that's what I did. I ended up going on all that stuff. And just to let you know, I have absolutely nothing against antidepressants at all. I'll work with a guy that's on antidepressants. You know, I don't play doctor in people's lives. The stuff that I'm a little leery of is when, you know, the narcotics and the, you know, being addicted to anxiety medication, working with people like that, it's a struggle. But antidepressants, I have absolutely nothing bad to say about it. Well, what ended up happening, where I thought I was crazy, right, I ended up drinking again. So now I'm drinking with the antidepressants, right? I'm drinking with the anxiety medication. I'm drinking with the Adderall. I'm drinking with all this stuff. And you know, I was sort of doing what Dr. Bob did for years. I was going from sedative to alcohol, sedative to alcohol. Well, what ended up happening, August 5th, was I almost died from an alcohol overdose, drug overdose. And what ended up happening is I had fallen asleep on the couch, because that's where I slept, and my wife had noticed that I had some, you know, some oozing out of my mouth as I was sleeping. Well, it was nothing for me to maybe sometimes pass out with food in my mouth. So she's thinking, you know, maybe fell asleep with ice cream or something in his mouth. It's a little embarrassing, but yeah, I fell asleep with ice cream in my mouth occasionally. But she went outside to talk to a friend, and then she came back in and she noticed I had that same, you know, foam coming out of my mouth. Well, what was happening is I was overdosing. I was aspirating into my lungs. And the paramedic said if he would have been 10 minutes later, I would have expired. I would have died. So then I woke up in the emergency room, and this big black doctor is looking over me, man, and he's just shaking his head. And he's like, Nick, do you think you might have a problem with alcohol and drugs? I'm like, no, this is just bad luck. You need to help me here, and I'll go back out, and everything will be fine. And for some reason, by the grace of God, I ended up in a detox. And when I ended up in the detox, I had what I think was my first God experience. And what that God experience was a voice saying, Nick, you're done. Okay? I knew there was nothing left for me out there. And the thing is, when I heard that, you would think, you know, cool, right? I was angry as heck at hearing that in my head. I'm thinking, great, God. So I get to go back to AA, right? AA failed. AA failed me. That was the delusion I was in. I had tried AA. AA failed. And God is playing a cruel joke on me because he's sending me back into AA to do meetings for the rest of my life. But I did meetings. I did it for a year, and I was crazier than hell. Crazier than hell. I'm talking about red outs on the road, chasing people down, not even knowing who I'm chasing. I could be chasing some UFC fighter or something. Who knows who I'm chasing? I didn't care. And, you know, I was crazier than hell. You know, I was depressed. I couldn't control my emotional natures. I was living all over page 52. And my buddy Bobby was working with a guy, which became my sponsor, which was a guy that I had met when I came in 1999. And he had always been a big book dumper. And it wasn't surprising to me when Bobby was telling me he was getting in the book. Because in the back of my head, I was going to find my sponsor. I just never got around to doing it. And what happened was, is, you know, Bobby was my boy, you know. Him and I could just completely just trash on AA, you know, just trash. And we co-signed each other's, you know, crap. And, you know, but I found he stopped doing that with me, you know. He was coming from more of a patient, love, and tolerant view, which was just making me mad, you know. And he told me, he goes, Nick, maybe you need to talk to Dave. Doesn't mind me saying his name. His name's Dave. And he said, you need to talk to Dave. And he goes, come out to our meeting. So I said, sure, what the heck, man? And so what happened is I go to this meeting, and I think, you know, I'll get there after the meeting's over. I'll talk to Dave. That hour and a half prior to me talking to Dave was the most uncomfortable hour and a half that I had spent that I can remember. And what happened right off the bat is I sit down in that meeting, and this guy is qualifying another person. And what I mean by qualifying is, let's find out where you're at in regards to using alcohol. And the guy was, you know, saying, you know, do you lose control? Have you lost power and choice? And maybe you're not alcoholic. And I'm hearing all this stuff, you know, a three-part disease. You know, there's three parts to step one. And I was like, man, I've never heard this stuff before. And then I'm thinking, man, have I been in AA for 20 years and I might not even be alcoholic? You know, I'm starting to get mad. I'm thinking, man, I could have been doing some drinking by now. And I remember thinking in that meeting when I'm hearing that type of stuff, I'm starting to think, you know what? I could go back out and drink. If my wife gets ticked off at me, I can tell her, I mean, you told me I wasn't alcoholic. You know? But like I said, it's weird how funny things, it's sort of funny how things work. I ended up talking to that guy after the meeting, and he qualified me. And what I mean by qualified, he was asking some questions about what my drinking looks like. You know, he asked, Nick, when you drink, do you lose control? Right? And basically, when I talk to a guy is, do you sometimes set markers with your drinking? You know, looking back at your experience, were there times you only wanted to drink 3? Were there times you only wanted to drink 6? Were there times you only wanted to drink a 12-pack? And you ended up drinking all night, maybe a binge of 3 or 4 days, right? See, we hit that marker and we pass it. When we pass it, we have what's called a phenomenon of craving. And he asked me if I had that, and I said, yeah, I have lost control of alcohol. He goes, well, let's look at the other part of the disease. He goes, have you ever tried quitting? And I mean, I saw that right off the bat. I go, man, have I tried quitting. You know, I mean, 30 times, I don't know how many times I told Dawn, I'm done. I mean, she just roll her eyes, like, okay. And I mean, I would literally be, I'd be done, and I'd go to a grocery store, and my hand would just pick up a case of beer because it was on sale. You know, and my wife would be like, well, you just told me you're going to quit. And I'd be like, look at the price of that case. Right? But when I started, when he qualified me that day, I realized, you know what? I'm beginning to find out what an alcoholic's all about. So when I look back at my experience from that point, I was never clear on what I was. I was never clear on the first step. So as he began to take me through the book, I began to have an experience with it. He wasn't taking me through it for educational purposes, right? He wasn't taking me through to learn cool things to say in the book. Because I hear a lot of people parrot things that are in the book. This was about having an experience with the book. You know, it says in the preface, you know, we look at, did that happen to us? Did I feel that way? And do I believe that this can work for me? And when I take those three questions and I start putting it into the book and I start turning statements into questions, I begin to have a whole new experience with it. And I'm telling you guys, the process is uncomfortable. And the reason why it's uncomfortable is we have preconceived ideas. I already had an idea I was alcoholic because I drank too much. It's got absolutely nothing to do with the quantity. And you know, later on in this process, I found that out. But with the phenomenon of craving, it's pretty plain and simple. Do you lose control? It seems easy. But the thing is, did you always lose control? Right? Because it was the times I didn't lose control that made me hard to see the times that I did. Being real alcoholic doesn't mean that the phenomenon of craving is going to set in every single time. It just happens, maybe we got poor bad luck, but it happens at the worst time. So in your experience, were there times that you should have been there for your family? Or there was something happening at work? Or there was something, a big deadline of some kind that you had to meet, and you ended up drunker than hell, and you didn't make it? That's what we're looking at. Doesn't have to happen every single time. So when I began to see the craving, we went into what's called a mental obsession. And a mental obsession is a little tricky because in AA, people call the mental obsession, it's the mental obsession of obsessing over alcohol. And that's a form of an obsession. I'm even far as to go to say that might even be a mental craving, maybe is what you would call that. But the mental obsession that the book talks about is the obsession that I can drink like other people. The obsession that this time it's going to be different. I've been away from alcohol for a while. My wife isn't bugging me so much about it right now, so maybe she's cool with it now. You know, that's the type of stuff that goes through a real alcoholic's mind. And this is the really dangerous part of the mental obsession, is I may not even be thinking at all. I may pick up that drink with not even a thought. And what I find out when I see that is not only do I lose power and control, but I also lose power and choice. Right? The book talks about lack of power is our dilemma. I lack power in control, and I lack power in choice, and I lack power in living life based on my own ideas. I can't pull off a spiritual life even if I tried. So when I saw this mental obsession, Teddy says it beautifully. It's insane for me to think that I... What is it? Say it. It's an insane place for me to think that I can't choose to drink. From an insane... You say it, Teddy.
From an insane place, I can't choose not to drink.
From a sane place... Okay. So basically, I've got this mental obsession I can't even see. Okay? And this mental obsession has set me up for a drink and I don't even see it. It's almost like you're playing chess with this mental obsession. It's got you checkmated before you even realize that you're even picking up that glass. And for me, my experience was that mental obsession always kicked in when my spiritual malady had manifested. And that's the third part of the disease. I've got a physical craving to alcohol. I have a mental obsession to alcohol. And I have what's called this unmanageability in my life. It's called a bedeviled life. I have irritable, restless discontent going on in my life all the time. Right? I'm trying to pull off a way of life that I can't handle on my own. And it always leads me back to drinking. Well, when I finally got to that part of the disease, not only did I see that I lost power and choice and power and control, I also lost power in living life on my own ideas, right? Well, what are my own ideas? Well, let's look at page 62. Where alcoholism isn't about alcohol. Alcoholism is selfishness, self-centeredness, driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion. That is alcoholism. Now, if I don't treat that, I'm going to find the nearest thing that I'm going to treat it with, and that was alcohol. And when you look at it that way, alcohol was never the problem. Alcohol was my solution. It was a solution that was literally killing me, but it was calming that voice in my head. It was bringing me to the present. So what it's about is taking me from a place of step one where I see that I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over drink, I'm powerless over stopping, I'm powerless over starting, and I'm powerless over living life, right? And what do I mean by living life? I'm doing miserable in my personal relationships. I can't seem to be a real help to others. I fall victim to misery and depression. Feelings of uselessness. Now, there are probably some people out there that have a substantial amount of sobriety that can still relate to page 52. You can have an unmanageable life sober, right? And when we look at choice, if I've lost choice in drink, how do I somehow regain choice to stay sober? Right? I come from the stance that God has given me my sobriety date. So if God is giving my sobriety date, what does choice have anything to do with that? Right? So basically in step one, I basically see how screwed I am. It is. I basically get to see that, you know, it's two alternatives. It's either die an alcoholic death or seek a spiritual basis of life. Okay? Well, when you're desperate and you don't want to die and you're willing to do whatever it takes and go to any lengths, I tell you what, step two begins to sound like a pretty good alternative. You know? It's amazing that the powerlessness that we see in step one brings us to the power of step two. You know, the last 5 minutes, you know, what? I guess I got 3 minutes. But, you know, the thing is, you guys, AA is about God. And I don't mean to sound like a zealot. You know, step two, what I'm finding out is about a willingness, right? I'm not asking you to believe in God. But you got to be willing that there's something bigger than you that's going to help you recover from this disease. Because in step one, if I see that I'm beyond human aid, that I've lost power, that's my true dilemma, I better seek something bigger than me, right? And it's got to be bigger than my group. It's got to be bigger than my sponsor. It's got to be bigger than that phone list I use. That reliance on God has to happen early on. Now, it's going to be that mustard seed, right? You're not even going to see it, you know? But if you trust in the process, right, and you begin to do the work, you know, that plant's going to grow. It's going to flourish. You know, but you've got to do the steps. You know, I know a lot of people, and I'm sure there's a lot of people out there, I still struggle with the God idea. I still struggle. I did. But the thing is, I didn't see how screwed I was in step one for me to even think it was a necessity for me to seek God. If I don't think I'm beyond human aid, why would I seek God? That's why the steps can be so uncomfortable, because it's digging in some truth that we have not seen. It's dismantling all those preconceived ideas that we've got about alcoholism. You know, when I work with somebody, and I'm across that table, and I begin to see those wheels turn, that turned in mine, and I can relate to that, there's nothing like that. There's nothing like that feeling. And the reason why I'm able to do that is because I've got a message to carry, okay? I'm not carrying a message of my opinions. My message is coming from the knowledge of the book and my experience with the book. My message is that of depth and weight. It's not a frothy message. And what I mean by frothy is, I was told them all my life, Nick, you better get sober or you're going to lose your girlfriend. You better get sober or you're going to go back to jail. You better get sober or you're going to lose your job. Well, if I'm truly power sober alcohol, and I drink past my consequences, none of that is going to work for me. Even when I come into AA, you keep coming back, play that tape through. Like I said, think about what I'm talking about tonight. If you believe in what the big book says and you've lost power and choice, how can I choose to use that phone list before I drink? Because I'll tell you what, the times I tried to use that phone list, I got to a point that I was convinced I didn't need to use the phone list. I don't need to use it. I'll use it when it gets bad again. I loved calling when I was already drunk. But, you know, this is a process. And like I said, sitting down with somebody, you know, it's not a selfish program. You know, a lot of people will challenge me and say, well, Nick, you work with people to stay sober. That's selfish. I don't work with people to stay sober. God is giving me my sobriety day. I believe He's got me sober for good and all. It says it in the book. I work with somebody else because it gets me closer to God. That is the AA work that God has assigned me. Plain and simple, this program is about God and nothing less. And if I put my reliance on you, it's only a matter of time until my grace period wears out and I go back out. Thanks.